Agre, in the beginning, Asa existed. Nabhivishyat, it will not exist. Ata, hence, Nidhanat Anu, after its annihilation. Mitam, deduced. Antara, in the meantime. Twayi, within you. Vibhati, it appears. Mrisha, false. Ekarase, whose experience of spiritual ecstasy is unchanging. Ata, thus, upamiyate, it is understood by comparison. Dravina, of material substance. Jati, in the categories. Vikalpa, of the transformations. Patai, within, with the varieties. Vitata, contrary to fact. Mana, of the mind. Vilasam, fantasy. Ritam, real. Iti, so. Avayanti, think. A Buddha, the unintelligent. Translation purport by the disciples of His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Translation, since this universe did not exist prior to its creation and will no longer exist after its annihilation, we conclude that in the interim, it is nothing more than a manifestation imagined to be visible within you, whose spiritual enjoyment never changes. We liken this universe to the transformation of various material substance into diverse forms. Certainly who believe that this figment of the imagination is substantially real are less intelligent. Report. Having thus defeated all attempts of the ritualists to prove the substantial reality of material creation, the personified Vedas now present positive evidence to the contrary, that this world is unreal and that it is temporary. Before the creation of the universe and after its dissolution, only the spiritual reality of the Supreme Lord, along with his abode and entourage, continue to exist. The Shrutis confirm this. Atmava idamika ivagra asit. Prior to the creation of this universe, only the self existed. Aitareya Upanishad 1:1. Nisadasi no sadasi tadanim. At that time, neither the subtle nor the gross aspects of matter were present. Rig Veda, 10.129.1. One can understand the relativity of creation by an analogy. When basic materials like clay and metal are processed and shaped into various products, the created objects exist separately from the clay and metal only in name and form. The basic substance remains unchanged. Similarly, when the energies of the Supreme Lord are transformed into known things of this world, these things exist separately from him only in name and form. In the Chandogya Upanishad, the sage Udalaka explains a similar analogy to his son, Itas shamyaikena mritpindane sarvam mrinmayam vikyatam shad vichar bhanam vikaro namadeyam mritiketyeva satyam. For example, my dear boy, by understanding a simple lump of clay, one can understand everything made from clay. The existence of transformed products is only the creation of language, a matter of assigning designations. The clay alone is real. In conclusion, there is no convincing evidence that the things of this world are eternal or substantial, while there is overwhelming evidence that they are temporary and conditioned by false designations. Therefore, only the ignorant can take the imaginary permutations of matter to be real. Srila Sridhar Swami prays, Ukuta kundala kankanka kakini parinatam kankanam paramartata maharahankriti ka paramukam tata narahare na param paramartata. Transformations of gold, such as crowns, earrings, bangles, and ankle bells, are not ultimately separate from gold itself. Similarly, the material elements headed by the Mahat, false ego, and ether are not ultimately separate from Lord Hari. Om Gyanati Manandisha Gananjana Salakaya Chakshurunitamina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Tubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyavicha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So many of our recent Srimad Bhagavatam verses in this chapter of the prayers by personified Vedas center on the nature of this material world. Whether this material energy, the material forms that we see are actually real or not real. This has been discussed in several verses. So now as we're concluding some of these arguments, they defeated many of the other arguments of how the material world is real or how the material world is not real. They are arguing that this material energy is both real and not real. And we talked about this in previous classes. So we understand that this material world in nature is real, as it is a material energy of Krishna. And therefore, it does exist. We can't say that this is all, that nothing is here. It is here. There is a reality of the material energy. But the material energy manifests at times and is not manifest at other times. And of course, it manifests objects in a temporary manner that exist for some time and then may become annihilated. So in that sense, it's unreal because it is temporary. And our attachment to those temporary forms is illusion. Or if we think that that is all in all, or we think that those material forms are, you know, the existential or substantial reality. So in Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's purport to this verse, he kind of explained it, wrapped it up nicely. He said, this world cannot be eternal since it was previously not existing and will be destroyed in the future. But it is shown to be real by comparing it to clay and gold, which transform into pots and golden earrings. It is not false like the silver in an oyster shell or the rope appearing as a snake. So in other words, the point in this verse that the personified Vedas were saying is that ultimately this is all Krishna's manifestation, and the material energy or the material forms did not exist prior to the creation, and after annihilation they will not exist. But at the same time, there's a transformation of material energy into the temporary objects that we experience in this world. And in today's purport and in Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's purport, they give the example of the clay in the pot. So we have clay as a material ingredient, just like we know that there are these basic material ingredients, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, that are Krishna's creation in this material world. Clay, of course, is earth. And so that earth is manifested or is formed into a pot or some other object. But that pot can be broken, of course, and it returns and becomes clay again. So it was clay, and then it manifests as a pot, and then it can be broken and go and return back to the clay. So we could sort of see all of material energy, material forms in this way. We have the gross material ingredients. Of course, we also have subtle energies. And those form in certain ways on a temporary basis. And then after they die or annihilated or destroyed, they return to the essential elements. And we can see this with all bodies in this material world. A tree is living and it has a constituent, you know, what's it constituted of? Different forms of earth, air, water, etc. The tree sometimes dies, it falls into the forest. What happens? It rots, it decomposes, and it reverts back to the basic elements of earth, water, air, and whatever else it was composed of. So this is the nature of the material world. So it is real, but it's temporary. And we should not be overly attached to those temporary manifestations that appear in this material world. So in many times, and particularly in yesterday's verse, this material world is referred to as illusory. I think about three times yesterday it was called illusory or imagination. And so this is a theme that comes up again and again, how this material world is an illusion. So he's thinking about that, what that means. And an illusion is something that appears differently from the reality, right? In other words, there's a reality. We see something, we perceive something, but it's actually something different. We're misperceiving. Therefore, it's called an illusion. And I was thinking of another word we often hear, and the Srila Prabhupada uses, comparing this material world to like a mirage, or a mirage in the desert, looking for material happiness in like a mirage. So I was thinking about this example of a mirage, and it's really quite interesting. And of course, you know, because I'm not a physicist, I had to look this up. But I was interested in what is a mirage? What is it really? Of course, we often drive down the highway and we see what looks like water appearing on the road or in the desert. You know, you might see something that looks like a pond or a lake. And when you get up there, there's nothing there. But then you might see that it's on down the road a little farther. Now, when does this happen? It happens on very hot days, basically. So what a mirage is, I learned, it's a distortion or refraction or bending of light. What happens is the pavement is very, very hot. Have you ever noticed if you're driving down 75 in the summer and it's 90 degrees out, but if you've got a thermometer in your car, it'll say like 96 or 98. And if you've experienced that, I have. It's much hotter on the road surface. And the air above it is cooler. And what happens is light travels in straight lines through homogeneous substances, you know, or media. But when when it's different, there's hot and cold, then the light bends and refracts. So what's happening is what you're seeing as water is actually a reflection of what? Light from where? The sky. It's actually from the sky usually. You're seeing the blue sky or whatever is now reflecting on the pavement and looks like water. Now, of course, why do we think that it's water, this reflection? It's not water. It could be glass. It could be a mirror, right? It could be so many things, but our mind, due to its conditioning, thinks it's probably water. Why? Because you don't usually see, you know, big sheets of glass on the highway or mirrors. But we do sometimes see after a rain that sometimes there is water standing. So that's a natural thing due to the condition of our mind to assume that that reflection that we're seeing, that mirror-like reflection, is water. So how does this apply? Similarly, by our conditioning this material world, we make certain conclusions about the illusion that's presented in this material world. So by conditioning, we conclude that this material world is permanent and is the only reality, right? Because this is what we see around us. We see people living and dying. The spiritual energy is not as manifest as the material energy. It takes special spiritual insight and realization to understand spiritual energy. So for the materialist, their reality is this material world. And therefore, they conclude this is the permanent reality of life. And therefore, an illusion is created in the same way that illusion, that reflection on the pavement is actually water. And we could take it a little further, as Srila Prabhupada often does, and you may think if you're very, very thirsty and you're out on the desert or the highway that, oh, finally there is water. This will quench my thirst. This will satisfy me. And we get there, there's nothing. There's asphalt or sand, as the case may be. And so the material world has that same illusory power of drawing us in, thinking that there will be something of enjoyment, something that will be there that will give us satisfaction. But we are actually no more satisfied by the things of this material world than the person dying of thirst is by that mirage in the desert. No, because they actually do not satisfy the soul. So by our conditioning, we conclude the material is permanent reality. And we think this world is permanent, and thus we also deny spiritual reality. So going along with the acceptance of material energy as the primary or permanent reality, we tend to not accept the spiritual energy or spiritual existence. So these are the two types. There are two types of illusion or mistakes in understanding the material world, and those have been discussed within the verses in this chapter. And in Vishnu Chakravarti's concluding statement on the end of the purport of today's verse, he sums it up nicely. He says, the jnanis who think this world is false, a mere mental fantasy, and karma mimamsakas who think the world is real and eternally existing, are both unintelligent. So what we're seeing is the two types of thinking that is actually incorrect or unintelligent. That is, by the jnanis who say, you know, nothing is real, or the material world is not real, everything is spirit, everything is one, there's no distinction, there's no variety. Or the karma mimamsaka is a basic materialist who think this world is real and eternally existing, and it's the all in all. And it's simply that they do sometimes understand karma and a little bit, you know, but they think it's all a mechanical process on, that goes on by the workings of the material energy. Now, it's interesting, in these two philosophies that are mentioned here, the jnanis and the karma mimamsakas, are somewhat similar to, in Western philosophy, of similar camps. Sometimes we refer to them as like idealism and materialism. So these concepts are not something obscure that are in India. These pervade both Eastern and Western philosophical traditions. So in Western philosophy, this idea of idealism has been there, which means to think that the material does not have factual existence. And one definition that I found said, it's a doctrine that ideas or thoughts make up fundamental reality. And one of the main proponents of this philosophy was René Descartes, famous for I think, therefore I am. You probably heard that. It's probably one of the few things that we all remember from philosophy classes. Descartes stated that all we really know is our own consciousness, and the whole external world is merely an idea or a picture in our minds. So that's the idea, the whole material world is not real, it's illusion, etc. And then in materialism, which is quite pervasive, particularly in modern scientific thought, is that everything is a product of material interaction. And another definition of that is a theory that holds that only thing that can be truly proven to exist is matter. All things are composed of material. All phenomena are the result of material interaction with no accounting of spirit or consciousness. So you sort of have these two diverse views that are both there in Eastern and in Western philosophy, and unfortunately, they're both incorrect, and they lead people to the wrong conclusion because they take people away from the conclusion that we understand from the Vedas that actually Krishna, God, is behind all of the spiritual material energies and that they are both real and not real. They are real, but they are temporary. And the permanent reality, permanent existence, is of the spiritual energy. So we have, several verses were quoted in today's verse from the Upanishads and from the Vedas, refuting these arguments. And I was thinking, even in Bhagavad Gita, it addresses these points many places, where Krishna describes the gross and subtle energies in the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, verses 4 and 5, talks about the gross and subtle elements. Then he talks about, you know, the jiva, who is spiritual energy. And then in verse 6 of chapter 7, Krishna says, of all that is material and all that is spiritual in this world, know for certain that I am both the origin and the dissolution. And that's similar to what's being described in the translation of today's verse, that all of this is really coming about by Krishna. And today it said, we liken this universe to the transformation of various material substances into various form. What we conclude, the interim is nothing more than manifestation imagined to be visible within you, Krishna, whose spiritual enjoyment never changes. So Krishna is there eternally. Krishna is the absolute principle. And he's enjoying eternally, but he manifests and unmanifests this whole material world. And then, of course, he says, Maya Dakshena Prakriti Siyate Sacharacharam 9:10. This material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O Son of Kunti, producing all moving and non-moving beings. Under its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. So we can understand from the Bhagavad Gita and from so many of the other sources, you know, the true nature of the reality of this material world. I was thinking why we spend so much time here, particularly in this chapter, talking about the material world, like why don't we just talk about Krishna and the spiritual world? I was thinking, I guess one of the real simple answers to that is we're here. We're here in the material world, and we're kind of stuck in this material world. We're trapped in this illusion. We're trapped in the illusion of thinking that we are of this material world. We are these material bodies. You know, everything that's happening, this is the all in all of life. So this is the plight of the materialistic conditioned soul in this material world. Therefore, to understand spiritual knowledge and to be able to get out of the spirit, out of this material world, one must understand very clearly what this material world is. One must understand how it's illusory, how it's temporary, but also how it's one of Krishna's energies, how it's coming from Krishna, maintained by Krishna. And as one of Krishna's energies, it can be utilized in Krishna's service. So this is the position of the devotee, that he understands the material energy is here. It is not something to become entangled in, but it is certainly something that can be used in the service of the Lord. So as we are all in the state of illusion, we come into this material world very much entangled by the material modes of nature. It's very difficult to overcome this material nature. That's what Krishna says also in the Bhagavad Gita. This material nature of mine is very difficult to, this, you know, Daivi Maya, very difficult to overcome. So how do we do it? How do we get out of the entrapment of the illusion of material world? Basically, we can only be lifted from that illusion, brought out of this material world by one who himself is not in illusion. So it takes one who is free to be able to free one who is bound in this material world. And of course, that's the position of the spiritual master. This is from a purport to 7.10 of Srila Prabhupada says, another meaning of guna is rope. It is to be understood that the conditioned soul is tightly tied by the ropes of illusion. A man bound by the hands and feet cannot free himself. He must be helped by a person who is unbound. Because the bound cannot help the bound, the rescuer must be liberated. Therefore, only Lord Krishna, or his bona fide representative, the spiritual master, can release the conditioned soul. So that's a very, you know, very succinctly put. We're bound by illusion. Only one who is not bound can free us from that illusion. And we were, over the last few days, well, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we had our first disciples course. Oh, no, it was not the first. It was the second disciples course we had here in Alachua. So I was teaching it for those days, and I think it's a very, very good course, and it's very instrumental in helping newer devotees who are getting ready for initiation to understand what the process of taking a spiritual master, the importance of the spiritual master, and how that relates with our ISKCON movement, how it relates to Srila Prabhupada. And so I think it was a very, very well done course. It's been worked on for several years, and of course now it's mandatory for all devotees to take before initiation. So we had a very, very nice group, about 14 devotees, and very good experience, I think, for all of us. And one of the points or one of the lessons in that course, it talks about the idea of Guru Padashraya, of taking shelter of the Guru. And so it's also explained there that, the idea of Guru Tattva, the spiritual energy of the Guru, it's actually coming from Krishna. Ultimately, Krishna liberates the conditioned soul. Ultimately, Krishna is our source of knowledge and deliverance. But Krishna works through his various agencies. He works through his devotees. This is the plan that Krishna has made, and he's explained many places in the scriptures. So that idea of Guru Padashraya actually means taking shelter and instruction of one's Diksha Guru, also taking shelter and instruction of many Shiksha Gurus. There can be many people who give us instruction, give us help along the way. Most of us did not first directly meet our spiritual master. We met other devotees. Those other devotees helped us in Krishna consciousness, taught us the philosophy, taught us about our sadhana, what we should do. These are all our informally or formally, you know, Shiksha Gurus, in a sense. So we have our instructing spiritual masters, we have our initiating spiritual master, and then there's a third leg, and that is the shelter instructions of our founder, Charya Srila Prabhupada. So we all know that, of course, Srila Prabhupada is the founder, Charya of ISKCON, is been what we have called the preeminent Shiksha Guru. So Srila Prabhupada's instructions are there for all time. as long as ISKCON is still around generation after generation. And so we have that very, very solid foundation of the words, the instruction, the books. We have letters, we have videos, we have, you know, recordings. We have so many things where we can take shelter also of Srila Prabhupada. And also, because Srila Prabhupada has that unique position as the founder acharya of ISKCON, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which I like to say every class, we are celebrating for the 50th anniversary this year. Haribo. So Prabhupada has been with us for 50 years in his Bapu form or in his Vani form now since 1977. And we can always take shelter of Srila Prabhupada and Srila Prabhupada's instructions, who continues to guide and inspire this movement and will continue to inspire and guide us for generations to come. So taking shelter of Srila Prabhupada, our various Shiksha instructing gurus, and of course our Diksha guru, if it's other than Srila Prabhupada, are all ways that we become connected. We become connected with Krishna through this line, through the Guru Padashraya, and are able to become liberated, able to understand these concepts, be able to get out of illusion, to become unbound from the material modes of nature, and of course, go back to Godhead. Jai. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. I'll stop there. Comments, thoughts, discussion?
This is from a science calculation, so take it with a grain of salt. But I saw a fun fact the other day. They said most atoms are 99.999% space.
Okay.
And they said if you remove the space from all of the atoms that comprise all of the human beings on the planet, you would get like a handful of matter.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
That's interesting. And of course, we know that space is the element of ether, right? You know, it's interesting that we were discussing one time when a guest speaker was here, but anyway, Hari Parayan, who's a physicist or something, you know, was talking about saying that basically the modern scientists don't accept the element of ether. I mean, they don't really know what it is. I mean, they accept, you know, other things, but it's interesting because it forms such a very, very integral and interesting part of understanding cosmology and understanding the nature of how things are put together. Yeah. So you could put all of our atoms taken out of space in your handful. Huh? That really makes us feel insignificant, doesn't it? Okay. Frank Govinda Prabhu.
I have a what I understand from that example you read, silver on the oyster shell. Say Brahma Purinam Bad, the Krishna or spiritual substance, that substance is real because it has a eternal existence.
Yeah.
And Shastra supports, Acharya supports. But when we say hallucination or seeing silver, because I'm familiar with the elements structure, what produce the inherent nature of that you can identify as a silver, that is not really found in the oyster shell.
Right.
So when you say silver on the oyster shell, it's actually false impression.
So it's illusion, yeah.
So in that sense, that your explanation of the Western ideology, or we say Gyani, so we are actually same in that sense. We are with them, because they explain the same thing. We also do. I'm not supporting their whole thing, but just that concept.
No, but they say that the material energy has no actual reality. It's all in the mind. It's basically, it's all a mental or intellectual process. They're saying there really isn't any oyster shell. There isn't any silver. There's no clay. There's no pot. Mm-hmm. These are just mental conceptions or semantic linguistic, you know, designations. So, yeah, I think they take it to a more, you know, the thing is there's all sorts of varieties of these philosophies too. you know, and like Plato is considered idealist, but yet he wasn't that extreme. So, yeah, there's a lot of overlap, I think.
So what you're saying,
I'm not really an expert, but you know, we'll get an expert opinion, I think, next.
No, but that's very interesting. You said, so the silver substance exists, and the oyster shell also exists. But my vision to see the silver in the oyster shell is the false impression.
Right. And probably gave example of the golden mountain. We know gold, we know a mountain. And then the other one, what was the other one he gave you? The rope and the snake.
Rope and snake.
Yeah. So in other words, your mind is put together the rope and the snake. Both are real, you know, which is a little different than the mirage, because the mirage, you're actually seeing it. You know, you can, it's not that it's an illusion. It's not that it's a hallucination. You can video, you know, you can go on YouTube and you can see videos of mirages. You can take a picture of them. I mean, they do exist, but it's our mind has misperceived. We have the misconception of what it really is. We think it's water. Anyway, different types, very subtle different types of illusion.
Yes, there's no end to it.
Yeah.
There's no end to it.
Yeah, because you get into this, so this is the jnani way. You can just fall into this endless debates and endless. That's what philosophers do.
I mean, we don't really see real water either. We're seeing light reflections of something that gets processed, who knows, electronically through the neurons, and somehow in the consciousness, we consider that water, you know, whatever that is.
Yeah.
One thing about the ether, you know, Hari Prayana mentioned that modern scientists don't accept the ether, but I think when modern scientists say that, they're thinking of a concept of ether that was considered real in the 1800s by physicists. And that may or may not be what the Vedas are talking about when they use the word ether.
Yeah. Because they wouldn't deny that there's this concept of space, obviously.
Yeah, in one sense we're talking names and labels.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Cool. Ishan? Or Jim? I'm sorry, Jim, I think was first. Could want somebody. Go ahead.
Can you help me to understand? Like, I think I understand that what we can see, what our culture considers as space, and what is the same as what our books are saying is ether, and that ether or space is really a substance, although a very subtle substance, and there's no place in the universe where there's nothing, which is what space means. Is that the right idea?
Yeah, I think that is a good distinction, because when the scientists talk about space, they may be referring to nothingness, where we consider ether or space is a subtle substance. It's not that it's nothing, you're right. It is a very, very subtle substance. Yeah. Janmashtami?
Like my friend Sureshwar has been teaching a founder Acharya seminar, and he says it's actually controversial. And prompted this question. How, you know, there's an obvious superiority of Srila Prabhupada over and above anybody else in terms of knowledge and instruction. How can one maintain faith in Diksha Guru, and so this is the area of the controversy, because there's all this emphasis on the founder Acharya. This is my understanding. So how can one maintain implicit faith in the Diksha Guru and also implicit faith in the founder Acharya simultaneously? I'm throwing this out because I think it is a
I don't think it's a contradiction. Would you say that we have faith in Bhaktisiddhanta's writings? Do we have faith in Rupa Goswami? We have faith in the previous Acharyas, as well as our faith in Srila Prabhupada. So to have faith in the Diksha Guru and also have faith in previous Acharyas is completely acceptable and expected. Now, if the idea is you could say, well, Srila Prabhupada, Rupa Goswami, Alexander, they're maybe in a different category or different class, and that might make a distinction. But the fact is that we're really talking about a system of parampara, a specific succession given by Krishna. And one who, and it's very clear in Srila Prabhupada, in many, many purports, and where Srila Prabhupada has made it clear that one who is following in the footsteps of the previous Acharya is qualified, you know, to give instruction, to give diksha, to others. Prabhupada gave the example of the postman. He said, the guru is like a postman. You know, he comes and he delivers the letter, delivers the mail unchanged. If he takes and opens your letter and writes some notes in it and gives it to you as his own interpretation, then that's not bona fide. But as long as he is delivering the message in the same way, unchanged and altered as his spiritual master has given him, then that message is pure and he's to be accepted.
Kind of another angle on the same question. You know, when shortly after Prabhupada left and the Dzogchenacharya era entered, and there was kind of Prabhupada's prominent position was a bit obscured, you know, in the name of, well, you got to surrender to your Diksha Guru kind of thing. So, anyway, it seems like we've kind of come full circle as a movement, you know, with this understanding of Guru Tattva.
I think so. I think now that there's a much deeper understanding, much more balanced understanding. And I would refer you, if you haven't read it, you can find it somewhere, the paper that was written, the GBC put out about 4 years ago about the role of Srila Prabhupada. And it makes it very clear that Srila Prabhupada has this unique role within our movement. It doesn't disregard or doesn't diminish the role of the initiating spiritual master, but it also makes clear the unique role of Srila Prabhupada.
That was Ravindra's paper?
Was just about a 2 or 3 page paper that was put out by the GBC. Ravindra's is like a 100-page book, you know, but it's quite good too, called Srila Prabhupada, Our Founder Acharya. I was just rereading that, and it's very, very nice. We have a question on the lady's side. We can take it over to Pavitra.
I think we're all pretty used to seeing material energy. I mean, I think we got that pretty clear. Can you explain a little bit, some of us who are still learning, or just to remind those of us who are studying for a while, how we can, when we see each other, not just devotees, but non-devotees, animals, and every living being, how we can see the soul, the living force within, because I think we kind of get matter, you know, we understand that, but how can we, they say, well, show me the soul, you know, well, we see we can perceive it by the fact that it's breathing and living, mm-hmm. but on a daily basis, you know, when we see, can you explain?
Well, I think you said it well yourself, that we perceive the soul by its symptoms. Srila Prabhupada explained that. We can't see the soul directly, but we see the soul acting. We see the soul acting through consciousness that pervades the body. We see it pervading through the life force that pervades the body. I would say, what's the difference between a living being and a dead one? The same material elements are there. What's missing is the soul. So it's the soul that actually gives life, that pervades the body, that gives consciousness. And that's something I think that a thoughtful person understands and even can perceive. Now, we may forget that, and sometimes we act upon other ideas or other concepts, mostly other past conditioning, other than a spiritual vision. I think the biggest problem we have, and even when you're explaining this to other people, many people can understand they're not their body. I don't find that, I've said this before, but I find that's not so difficult. But what people have more problem with understanding how they're not their subtle body, their mind and their intelligence and ego. Because people tend to think what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, what I like, what my beliefs are, this is really me. And it's not. It's your subtle body. And who's really you, your spiritual being, your spiritual essence, your spiritual personality, who eternally exists in the spiritual world of the Goloka Vrindavan Krishna, that we're not so tuned into. We're not as realized to understand that. But we do have to understand that is there, and it's there within every living entity. Yeah.
He said, I never believed in the soul, and then I was having an operation, and I actually saw myself from below, looking at myself, you know, he said, and then I realized I wasn't that body, and, you know, I was at work, so I couldn't really get into the philosophy of how well mind, intelligence, and false ego is a subtle body, but that's not you either, but that's a good point, because a lot of people think that, you know, I am the subtle body, yeah. And that's, you know.
Yeah, we all team devotees. We tend to get caught in that, right? You know, think, well, I think this. Well, who is it? Is it the jiva? Is it the pure spirit soul that thinks that, or is it my conditioned mind? You know. Now, that's not to say that we can't use the mind intelligence. Of course we can in Krishna's service. And in fact, one of the definitions of intelligence is the ability to distinguish material from spiritual. So that's spiritualized intelligence. As our mind and intelligence becomes more advanced, more spiritualized, we're able to use them more and more in Krishna's service, and they become more and more purified. You know, still eventually, the purification process, our whole body, gross and subtle bodies, will be fully spiritualized and, you know, simply serving Krishna. Okay, Ishan? Probably last one. We're about out of time.
Maybe you can help me to understand, because I've been out of touch with the official statements of the movement and their official position on certain things, on anything. Like I read in Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Srila Prabhupada says that a spiritual master should be a Mahabhagavata who has, you know, a direct relationship with Krishna. And does the movement ISKCON, I'm not trying to be controversial at all, not at all. I just want to understand, because I may have to speak to somebody who's asking questions, but I don't know the official answer, so to speak. How does the movement teach those who are coming and take the position of saying that, do we take all the Diksha Gurus as Mahabhagavatas, or do we understand that they're also in the process of spiritual growth? Should we view it? If I want to represent ISKCON speaking to somebody, how should I say?
Well, I think there's been an evolution of thinking on this, and I guess when I'm stating is perhaps what I would say is the current thinking, understanding within ISKCON, as far as at least the leadership in the GBC, is that the Diksha Guru may or may not be a liberated soul. He may or may not be a Bhagavad. Prabhupada says, of course, it's best if one is on the Uttama Adhikari platform, but he says even Kanishtha and Majjham may also give Diksha. And also Prabhupada says that the main qualification is not that one is liberated, but that one is following, you know, the liberated soul. And therefore, that's another reason why the shelter of Srila Prabhupada is so important, and why we emphasize the position of the founder Acharya. Because if we're all following Srila Prabhupada and speaking on behalf of Srila Prabhupada, then we're safe. And, you know, in other words, the exact Adhikari or spiritual qualification of the particular Diksha Guru, we don't need to speculate so much on what their personal level of understanding Krishna is, as long as they're representing Krishna, they're acting properly, they're speaking, and being able to instruct others in the science of Krishna consciousness. Yes.
So how can someone who doesn't have a relationship with Krishna introduce you to Krishna?
Well, first of all, everyone has a relationship with Krishna. You have a relationship with Krishna. I have a relationship with Krishna. You know, we may not fully realize it or be fully manifested, or perhaps not acting in our siddhadeya, our original constitutional position, but we all have a relationship with Krishna. And part of that relationship is our relationship with our guru. So if I have a relationship with my spiritual master, who is a pure devotee, and I'm representing him and speaking on behalf of him what Srila Prabhupada has said, then that's perfect. I may not be perfect, but I'm acting perfectly. What I'm saying is perfect if I'm following the perfect pure devotee.
What I mean is if I know, what's his name, the president, Obama, and you want to meet Obama, I can say, well, I'm going to his house this afternoon, you can come with me, but if I don't have any access to him, how can I introduce you to Obama? I don't mean theoretically, because I think you're talking in a theoretical context, that are following properly, etc., and they're staking the same, making the same statements as the previous acharyas. So they're,
but you're making an assumption that you're ready to go see President Obama, or you're ready to have a direct, personal, fully spiritual, realized relationship with Krishna. And therefore, there could possibly be a limitation, because Srila Prabhupada said in some of those verses and purports that one cannot make further spiritual advancement than one's spiritual master. And I think that's the point you're making. But if you get to that point, you know, where you're, you know, have gone far beyond your spiritual master, I think Krishna will take care of you somehow. Krishna will make the proper arrangement. We'll send you the Shiksha Guru. We'll instruct you within the heart. The Chaitya Guru is in the heart. All these are means of advancement and deliverance. So I don't think we need to worry so much that the new devotees are going to shoot ahead of their Diksha Gurus to the point where there's going to be a problem. In fact, if they do, that's probably a good thing. And I'm confident that, you know, Krishna's ultimately deliver, and he will make those arrangements in many ways. I think we should end there. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Bol. I am sure you can, and I don't. I'm not in charge.